So hello everybody, my name is Neil McIntosh. I work at Microsoft, where I'm lucky enough to lead the static analysis team who work on C++. And unsurprisingly to me, that's what I'm going to talk to you about today, static analysis and C++, more than lint. So I thought I'd mention lint in the title of the talk because according to the internet, which is where I get almost all of my information from, it's a completely reliable source, lint was written roughly 36 years ago. And so I thought it was time to see, is lint still relevant? What have we grown out of that initial starting point for C? And let's take a look at the experience we've had at Microsoft trying to apply lint-like tools at scale, what we've learned from that. And hopefully the talk will give you a little bit of a story, a bit of a journey that we went through and where we went ended up today and how we got to thinking the way we're thinking at the moment about things like the GSL and some of the checking tools that were talked about in Bjarne's keynote or Herb Sutter's plenary session yesterday. So let's make a start. Oh, code, nice. So the talk's going to be example driven. For a couple of reasons. One is I lack imagination and I find it easier to borrow other people's code and put it up on the screen for you. The other reason is I know I find it easier to walk through examples and think about them. And the third reason is I'm hoping to entertain you a little bit because in that sort of America's funniest home videos sense, there's nothing as satisfying as looking at other people's mistakes, especially if they're on a big screen. So with that said, all my code examples that I'll show you today, I have adapted and sanitized to try and protect the innocent who authored them. And that may or may not be me in some cases. But all of the code examples are drawn from real live commercial code bases that I have looked at with my tooling over the years. So although they look like toy examples, I can promise you all of them are real bugs from production. So you've all had a little while to look at this example in particular. It's an easy one, it's a warm-up, because hopefully most of you think about writing correct code rather than bugs. So it takes a little while to flip you to the mindset of where's the bug in this. So this is C-like code, but this is very, very common. It was an API which had to have C-ABI compatibility, and so the caller is expected to allocate a thing themselves, pass it to a function that initializes a thing, and then they can do other things to the thing with other function calls. The usual sort of C-style pattern for doing APIs. Very common. And of course, when we get our thing in, we check to make sure we got one that wasn't null, and then we make sure we mem set it out to zero, and then we set some of the fields to certain values, leave other ones at zero, and so on. Except, as I'm sure somebody in the room has noticed by now. Exactly. We didn't mem set it to zero. And luckily, at Microsoft, we run some tools, some static analysis tools that help tell us this. They point out that we're overflowing the buffer. Why are we overflowing a buffer? Well, because we're memsetting the pointer, variable thing that was passed in. Whereas what we meant to do was memset the memory pointed to by thing. And so we get this error message that tells us, more or less prettily, but that's exactly what we're doing. The buffer is 4 bytes long, the size of a pointer on this particular platform we were building for, and you're trying to access 12 bytes. Okay, so struct thing is slightly misrepresented up there. It should say 8 bytes, and I've truncated it too much to fit it on the screen. But you get the idea. We're writing more memory than we have access to writes to write to. So it's a simple enough bug. It's easy to make. Simple fix. It's one character the difference. Really easy bug to write, really hard bug to track down. Depending on what the stack looks like, what operating system you were on, or what compiler you were using, whether or not you've got stack checking turned on in the compiler, and all these other bits and pieces. Because when you memset past it, a lot of the time, it'll just write some bytes. Write some bytes somewhere to zero. And maybe that'll be a bad thing, and maybe it won't. Hard to find, easy to find for static analysis tools. So the point of that wasn't just to warm you up. It was to give you the value proposition that lint brings to software development. And I say value proposition because I work for a great big corporation and everything's a value proposition where we are. But it does have a value proposition, and that is to save you time and money, right? If you find some defects early, before you check them in, before you compile or before you commit your code to source control, then they're easier to fix. They're cheapest to fix then, 10 minutes after you wrote them. not down the track when you've built them or when you're running tests, or even worse, when you've shipped the software and the customers are falling over them. And it saves you money because it's really costly to update your software, as I'm sure a lot of people in this room know, and ship it out to customers. I work at Microsoft, I'm sure everybody's familiar with those updates that come around once a month. Sit there and install onto a Windows machine you either use or somebody related to you uses and usually asks you, why is my machine doing this? Can you help me fix it? No. No, I can't. So Lint's value proposition has been pretty successful over the years, and we see it's been incorporated into all sorts of tools, right? So compilers all have running at, you know, wall, and a lot of the checks that run at wall as compiler warnings started off in the original Lint tool, right? There's lots of free and commercial offerings for doing static source code analysis. So you can use slash analyze in Visual Studio, you can use Clang Tidy or Clang Analyze, Coverity, you know, there's a bunch of these tools out there. So clearly the Lint value proposition has resonated with people. And if you're not running these tools, some of them, all of them in your source code, you should be, because they bring a lot of value to the table. If you think they don't bring that value, please let me take this opportunity to encourage all of you to complain really loudly to the people who write the tools. As somebody who does that, there is nothing worse than the meh of apathy when somebody runs a tool, says, oh no, it's too noisy, it's not helpful, and just turns it off again. At least take the time to tell us why it wasn't useful to you so it gets better. If it's an open source tool, even better, take the time to try and contribute and make it better. Add a pattern for something that it missed. Another example, I've talked enough. So this is a slightly different example. Before we were doing something that was clearly wrong. We were overrunning a buffer, overrunning the size of an allocation, and that was a bad thing. This bug is different. Okay, there's nothing illegal about this bug. There's nothing where it's overstepping bounds or doing anything wrong. It's a super simple bug, and I'm sure you've all seen what it is by now. It took me a while to see it when I first looked at it, and it took the people who wrote it a very long time to find it in the source space. And they only went looking for it because they were debugging and they were wondering why their service was so expensive in its idle loop. The answer was it was never reaching that idle loop. Because of course, somebody copied and pasted, or maybe somebody just chose the first option given to them by IntelliSense, or maybe they just made a genuine mistake. And they should have set current to stopped before they went on and made that if test. Now there was a little bit of code in between setting the current state to stopped and then testing did we really stop in the original, but it wasn't that much code. So that you had, it took you a real while to look at this and work out, because it looks valid. It looked valid to me. I thought, oh yeah, I'm missing something. Of course, they set it back to started and then they do something. No. They meant to set it to stopped. And so they never went and waited for a restart. Well, they didn't have to because they never stopped. Great. It's a logic bug. How do we find this bug? Right, so this is a little intro to thinking about, now I've warmed up, seen a couple of bugs. How do we find bugs like this when we do analysis? So remember I said the bug results from the fact that mCurrent gets assigned a value. And then when we go to the if test, that if test is always going to be false because mCurrent can only have the value it was just assigned. This is not multi-threaded code. That's how our analysis tools think about things. It's a concept called abstract execution or symbolic execution or interpretation. We construct from the source code a rough graph of control flow here, and we just walk through it and we can store some values for mCurrent based on what we see going on in the function. So we might say it's unknown at the beginning of the function. We get to mCurrent equals state started. We know it has a very definite value at that point, so we can record it. And then we can walk on and we can look at that if test and we can say, you know, is the if test against unknown values or is it against known values? And it turns out that on every path through this function, it was against the same known value, which was not the value being tested. So in other words, that if statement was always false, provably false. Therefore, wait for start is dead code. And that looks suspicious. And so that's what the tools tell the user. It's suspicious sort of code. You're never going to enter it. It's always false. So it's a different type of bug, a logic error, as opposed to a sort of a correctness error. So Lint's valuable, we've warmed up. Let's talk about how you scale Lint. How do you make it work on really big source bases and get the value out of it? Here's some lessons we've learned from our experience at Microsoft. And number one is the most important. You need to be fast. You need to be in that edit, build, debug cycle that, you know, some people, at least at my company, called the inner loop of the developer, right? If you're not in the inner loop, you may as well go home in terms of getting their attention and bringing value to them. There's a place for larger scale analysis. There's a place for, you know, test results run 6 hours after you've checked in, or 1 or 2 days after you've checked in. All those things bring value, but if you really want to get people's attention and get bugs fixed early, you have to stop them early too. So your tools need to be quick. They need to be obviously bringing value to the people using them. They need to give them actionable warnings. So you can't have too many false positives. You can have some. People surprisingly will tolerate them, particularly if they tend to point you at code that's suspicious anyway. One of the things that first surprised me when I started working in this area is even the false positives will often point you to real bugs, just not the bug the false positive claimed. They're often just a sign of a bad smell in code. So if you can get your tools generating those sorts of false positives, it's a good thing. Where it's a true positive, people have to actually understand what the problem is and how they can fix it and do it quickly. You do those things, you get buy-in. Seems obvious, but buy-in's important when you're trying to appeal to thousands of engineers who are trying to get through their daily job, just like everybody in this room, as quickly as possible, get home, have a life, have a weekend, and they see a tool that tells them there's a bug in their code as an interruption to that path to the sweet time. So you've got to be helpful to them. The other thing you want to do if you're running at scale is don't just look for safety and reliability bugs, like the first one we looked at. The second bug we looked at is equally important. It's a logic error. But there's also a valuable place for using static analysis to do other things that are useful to you. So one of them is, got a bunch of APIs that you know are dangerous or old. Maybe you've got some crypto APIs that your company once shipped that you now think are maybe not quite as secure as they should have been. You want to move somebody to the new set of crypto APIs. It's easy to identify with static analysis which APIs should be deprecated and how to move them. Maybe it's just a parameter that should be deprecated on the API. Again, another really good opportunity to use static analysis and give some value back to the company. Performance has become an increasingly interesting target for static analysis. Tools can know certain types of routines, certain types of callbacks might be performance critical. Maybe they're only run intermittently in sleep mode of a device, or maybe you know that they are on a critical path of some part of the kernel or similar. If you have that sort of knowledge in a tool, then you can stop people making really expensive, say, cross-process calls or writing little busy loops or doing too much work at all. Maybe there's certain APIs you should never call when you're in a particular callback or mode because they will cause the machine to wake up or wake up the disk and so on. So again, you can provide lots of useful hints with static analysis that help people get their job done faster and with less stress. So let's look at the first of these, fast turnaround. How do you achieve this with static analysis tools? It's pretty hard, it turns out, because the tools at least have to have the same sort of work done as the compiler. They need to do parsing, they need simple tables, they want types, they want all that sort of work. So we're piggybacking at least on compilation. So at the very least, people have to have the same weight as they do to compile their code. They're probably generating code from that as well. And so then you're running afterwards. So you're already making them take longer than they would have otherwise have done. So there's a couple of things we can do. You can run asynchronously. We've found it's really useful to say, oh, you're kicking off a build, you're compiling, you've got a ton of processors sitting on this machine, or at least it's got the capacity to run a ton of threads. We'll do the static analysis compilation at the same time as build. Or we can do it in the background if it takes a little longer and come back to you. Helps to do as much parallel execution as you can. Obviously, incremental is very important. You can't always do all the work each time. The most important lesson we learned is share the common work. If you're going to go and construct things like parse trees and symbol tables, reuse them. The first time you try and roll these tools out at scale, there's a tendency to say, oh, I'll just write another tool, throw it in, the tool does all the same work. It picks up whatever the compiler built and then it starts doing some analysis on it. The next one does the same thing. And you suddenly find you've got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 copies of the same information being generated and used to provide the analysis. And the time taken to get analysis results back is taking longer and longer, and the value is correspondingly shrinking for the user. So the things we learned are have a common engine if you can, and reuse that sort of infrastructure to do your checks, and keep the checks simple. That also helps with false positives and accuracy. There's two types of checks that we think are the best ones to try and focus on for performance. One is what I call syntactic checks. So these are super simple. You can do these against a parse tree, and this is a little like what I talked about before when we talked about enforcing APIs, right? You're just looking for a particular function call, maybe. Particular function call with a particular set of arguments. It's pretty much pattern matching against a tree. It's fairly fast, it's fairly reliable, scales well. Simple flow-sensitive checks. We looked at one of those examples before. If you're going to walk through a function and track some values, you want to track a tractable number of values. You want to try and bound it so that your running time is small. So you say simple, but still flow-sensitive. Let's have a look at how we might do one of those things. So our first example with the bad mem set. So there's a good example of something that's really essentially just a syntactic check, believe it or not. That's a sort of a vague representation I pulled out on the screen of what a syntax tree from our compiler might vaguely look like by the time we see it in static analysis for that mem set call. It's pretty much, pardon me, got all the information you need to be able to flag the bug. Okay, it tells you, oh, you're doing a size of type there, that type is 8 bytes, looks like I got it right on this slide at least. You know, you're taking the address of thing, and it's giving you the type of the result of that operation. It's a pointer to a thing pointer. Ooh, that looks like the wrong type, doesn't it? And in fact, we can go to a symbol table, which I haven't shown here, look up, what's the size of that thing? Ooh, it's 4 bytes, much smaller than the 8 at the bottom there. So all we really have to do here is flag this, go look up a symbol table size, we're done. I've got a question over there. Oh, there could be. Oh yeah, that's true. That is an error on my slide. Thank you. There's many of those. But you get the idea. A quick syntax tree check and we can find the bug. If we go look at the second example we did, also this is a good example of simple flow sensitive analysis. So okay, we can just track maybe for certain classes of variables. Current's just an enumeration variable, it's like an integer, so it's either unknown or it has a known value. We can track it through the function, and we can see what its value might be just at if tests. It's a fairly simple flow-sensitive check. Not a lot of work being done, but we can get a lot of value from it. There's a popping up our warning again. So the other thing I ask us to do is make defects obvious and actionable. So one way to do that is to use heuristics to restrict the number of false positives we spew out, to narrow the surface area of what we're going to warn about. A couple of things here. One is try and differentiate between success and failure paths, right? Do all roads lead to Rome is one question we often find ourselves asking, and that's sort of what we saw in the last flow-sensitive example, right? Does every path leave this test with the same value of false? If they all do, all roads lead to Rome, then that's more than likely a problem you want to tell the user about. If there's a possibility it could be non-false on one path, well then maybe that test really is what they're meant to do. So you can use simple heuristics like that to be much more accurate in the sort of results you provide people with. So context matters tremendously. Let's look at an example of where context matters when we're going to report errors to people. So here's another interesting case. Somebody's initializing a system, they're bringing up what sort of functionality am I going to provide to the user? What sort of hardware maybe am I going to turn on and off? So I'm going to look at a flags integer that's been set up somewhere with a set of bit flags. I'm going to say, do I want to enable the cool stuff? If so, I better bring up that hardware. Otherwise, I'll just enable the standard stuff. So that expression, it turns out, will evaluate to 0 at compile time. By design, because this is a popular pattern people follow for making sure that they, on purpose, have some dead code. Maybe the cool stuff board isn't ready to run yet. So I want the code paths in there, I've been working on them and so on, but I need to turn them off. I turn them off because I didn't put enable cool stuff in G flags. So there's dead code in there. If we warn them about the dead code, people say, your tools are noisy, your tools are useless. This is what I've always thought about your tools. I'm turning them off. And then we didn't scale. We didn't bring them the lint value proposition. But we can use some important context in this example to help us narrow things down. In this case, which comes from real code, Unfortunately, somebody forgot to set at least the first value of their enumeration when they wrote it out. So that even when they did say, yep, the board's ready to go, let's have the cool stuff enabled, they couldn't work out why it wasn't working. Luckily, our tool could. And then we're able to say, you know what? You've got a zero-valued flag there. And we're able to use our knowledge of how the enumeration is defined, which is just held for you in the symbol table, and say, well, it was the first enumeration. It was given zero, and now they're testing it against a flag. That looks kind of dodgy. So that context helps us say, this time we should omit the error. Much lower chance of being a false positive. And people get less angry about it. So you want clear warning messages. Okay, that's a big part of making things actionable. And if we go back, I'd have to say that is not the clearest warning message, and that is unfortunately the actual warning message in our shipping software today for that particular bug. It would be nice if instead we could say, and I should take a work item to go do this, pop that on my backlog, Andrew, I know you're out there somewhere, my PM, thank you, to say something like, look, you're using this particular flag and it's zero. It's always going to be zero. Tell the person what the problem is. Point them back to where in the source something went wrong and suggest what they should have done instead. So that's part of having good error messages. Together with good error messages, good diagnostic traces. So we saw a little bit of this in the demo I did with Herb on stage yesterday. You can see a trace in Visual Studio when you get a warning message, and we even pop up this nice box that tries to tell you what the analysis tools were thinking as they walked through a particular error. So this is our way of doing it, but you know, I know there's other equivalent sort of tooling and equivalent sort of IDE experiences from other vendors, and I think places we see real innovation are with things like fixits in Clang Tidy. Right, this is a fantastic thing. The ability to not only say, hey, this is what I think is wrong, and this is why I think it's wrong, but I can even fix it for you if you want. It's really nice. So enough about how to make it scale just from the nuts and bolts perspective. What happens when we try and go further? So far, we've just looked at some trivial local examples. We've talked about the things we all know. Oh, I missed an ampersand in my mem copy or my mem set, you know. These are sort of your traditional lint problems. But what happens when we try and find deeper bugs, solve harder problems? A bit like the lifetimes problem we talked about yesterday. Problem is that no function's an island. We immediately hit the fact that real software is composed of lots and lots of function calls, and we want to understand what they're doing. Otherwise, we can't understand what's happening to the values and the storage as we move through all those calls in a program. So we've sort of got two broad options for dealing with that. So one is to do interprocedural analysis, where you analyze all of the code, whole program analysis, look at what happens, move the information from call to call, simulate full execution of the whole thing. That's at one extreme. So that is a hard problem, NP hard type problem. So I was put in mind yesterday in Herb's talk, he kept referring to 42, the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And in the book that comes from, obviously, there's a great big computer-built Deep Thought, which churns away for millions of years and finally comes up with the answer being 42. It's very similar to the way interprocedural analysis tends to run. It goes and churns for years and years and years, does lots of deep thought, and gives you a somewhat cryptic, but sometimes very important answer. Hopefully it's often more important than 42. But it does take a long time to get there, and it gives you a lot of other information along the way. It's useful, but it's not in the inner loop. And that's what we talked about with scaling before. So when I think about global whole program interprocedural analysis, the way I think about it is, it's great to have in your organization. It's an incredibly invaluable tool. It's an incredibly valuable tool, but it's not something you put in the developer's inner loop because it can't run in there. It just doesn't have the time and space. It can act as an advisor, maybe later. It can act as a gate. It can act as a final quality check, but it can't really help them as they're compiling individual translation units and moving towards building some new piece of functionality, the way intra-procedural or function at a time local analysis can, which is what we've looked at so far in the talk. So, if we look at intra-procedural, how do we, intra-procedural, if we look at that, how do we handle the fact that we've got all these function calls and we can't see what they're doing on the other side? We're only looking at the current function we're in. So we need to have a way to work out what the meaning of those functions is. What are their semantics? So we've got some options. We can take a guess. We can know some of them that are special. You saw us doing that earlier with the memset call. We know what memset does. It writes to memory, so we can find bugs based on it. We can look at what the type system tells us about the functions. We can annotate them too in source. So let's use an example to drive some decision making here. And this process reflects pretty much what happened over the course of 10 or more years at Microsoft as static analysis evolved. Now the code you're looking at on the screen is a super simplified representative example of the Heartbleed bug that was popular, was it late last year, I think? And basically that bug was all about perhaps trusting your packet, your incoming network data too much. Okay, so if we look at this example, we get, again, it's very C style, but this is exactly the sort of code you often see in a code base as large and old as ours, and especially, and lots of other people's, to be honest, and especially in network type code, you'll often see more C style code. So here we've got a received packet. It's a packet of bytes. I've given us byte there to make things a little bit easier. It's got a length, it's got another size, and that's the buffer we need to write out to with a response. And so in this case, it's a bit like a ping. We're just going to take what we got, write it back out to a buffer, and then send it back to the person to say, yep, got your data, saw it, here it is. So the code is pretty simple, unsurprising. The bug is that the way we're calculating how much data to copy into buffer is unrelated and untested against the actual length of that buffer. So the input data comes in, we read the header from it, and it says, this is how many bytes you should copy out of me. And we just say, okay, we'll copy that many bytes. Whether or not that's actually the number of bytes that are accessible via the pointer rec. Whoops. And so that turns out to be an information disclosure type vulnerability. So you could craft packets that go to this and get it to overrun the buffer and send you back more than you intended to send back. And then people can see all sorts of interesting things like passwords that they're interested in picking up. And if we look at the call site for a function like this, which is pretty representative, we've got a read and a write going on. So let's look at potential mistakes we could get here as well. Now remember, if we go back to makepacket for a moment and look at its declaration, it's one of these tremendously useful declarations that I think Bjarne's talk pointed out, maybe Herb highlighted as well. A couple of pointers and a couple of integers. Really meaningful stuff. To an analysis tool, could be anything. I don't know what the integers mean. I don't know what the pointers are. It's hard to, I could maybe, with a lot of work, infer their relationships from looking at the code. But in this case, it might be difficult given that you're not using the relationship in the memcopy call. So there's a couple of pointers and a couple of integers. So when you make a call, well, you read the documentation, you look at the help, maybe you look inside the function. You've got some buffers, let's imagine they're vectors in this case, to be a bit more C++-ish. You read into a vector. You pass the contents of what you read into makepacket. You give it another vector to write into, which presumably you gave some standardized size that should be big enough. And then you write it out again. And if everything went fine, that's okay. There's a problem with this code as well. And so the problem is that we're just telling makepacket, hey, here's the length of the buffer. But that's not the length I read into the buffer from the network. If we look at the comment above socket read, it tells you how many bytes it read into the buffer. But we didn't ever use that return value except to see did you fail. That's a very common bug again that we see in people's code. So with static analysis tools, we could try to catch either of these bugs with purely local analysis. But we'd be incredibly noisy if we warned about either of them. So we don't. So that leaves us here. It's a terrifying place to be. A giant sad face. Giant sad face because we've got buggy software, it's hard to call correctly, it exposes security vulnerabilities in the system, and there's nothing the static analysis tools can do about it. It's a sad day. So what can we do to fix it? Well, I mentioned annotations, and that's where we went first. We discovered this amazing concept, which was add to the language. Add some macros that look just like language. And there you are in baby blue. Plop them all over your function declaration. And they look a little bit esoteric, but if you've worked with them for a few years, they start to look really perfectly reasonable, I promise. So the first thing that annotation tells you there is it says, hey, this function succeeds if the return's greater than or equal to zero, which is pretty much what the function agrees is the case, and probably what a comment on the function would have originally said. And then the in reads there tells you that the buffer pointed to by rec can be expected to be rec length bytes long. They're all initialized bytes. You can safely read from them, but you shouldn't write to it. And the outwrites too, well, that one's really nice and esoteric with all its different parameters in there. It says, look, I expect you will be writing to this buffer that the annotation precedes, and I'll expect that there's a capacity for that buffer of buff size, and that you will write to anywhere up to return, which in this case is the return value of the function, bytes into that buffer. See, it's easy as pie. Start reading them, and after a while, they're just magic and natural. But the good news is, they do let the tools work out what went wrong. Now, I will certainly admit that that warning message is anything less than easy to understand or read. But, just like the annotations, if you've been reading them for a little while, a couple of years, maybe more, then you can quickly see that what that annotation is telling you is the simple fact that payload length is not in any way related to rec length. And so you're probably overreading the buffer, which is in fact the problem. So yay for annotations. They help us catch the bug. So now let's go look at the call sign. What can annotations do here? Well, we probably could now catch the read buffer size problem. We could probably say, that's not the right length. Probably. But remember when I said in reads just says that many bytes has been allocated and they're initialized to some valid value? Well, that's what a vector does, right? So readBuffer.size still meets the criterion that the annotations on bad packet, which should be called mate packet there, set out originally. So this illustrates one of the problems with annotations is you think you're being precise, but maybe not precise enough. Maybe you're not carrying enough information to help a bug being caught. So how could we improve the situation and catch the caller involved in the whole Heartbleed disaster here as well? More annotations, of course, because they helped us before. So having more of them can only help us more, right? And if you rinse and repeat and do this long enough, and a company I work for did, then you end up with millions of annotations in your code base, just like this. And they are really helpful. They do help you catch bugs. So in this case, you know, your socket read now says, hey, if it's less than zero, then it failed. Otherwise, it's going to write to this buffer this many bytes. And the buffer has to be big enough to hold them. It's going to be buff size. And it's going to write somewhere between return and buff size bytes. Somewhere up to return bytes, which is less than buff size. See, they're really easy. They just roll off the tongue. And you can annotate write as well. So now we can go find that bug. We can issue a message. It's still a little bit dodgy because we're still not 100% sure that read initialized that data in any different way from vector's default initialization of the data would have done. But we can give people a warning with some confidence that something's going wrong here. So annotations made things better. So that's a fairly subtle bug. It's a significant bug that cost a lot of people a lot of money. And we can find it now with annotations. So annotations are good. We did make the behavior of the functions much clearer, assuming you know how to translate those annotations into some sort of mental model and you've spent a couple of years sort of loading all of that into your brain. However, You notice they were viral. We put them on one function and suddenly we needed to put them on the next set of functions that called that function. And you need to put them on the functions the function calls. As I say, you suddenly end up with millions or tens of millions of annotations everywhere. And they're not really the source code. So do people update them when they're maintaining the system? They're like a language extension, really. And they're non-portable as a result. It makes it harder to exchange code with other people. And they tend to rot. People tend to write an annotation that's right once, and then they leave it. You know, because if they're not getting a warning from a tool, why would they change it? So this is how we feel after we've used some annotations about our example. Meh. Yeah. We're not sad anymore, but we're not super happy. Can we do better? I think so. So, sorry, I've moved my warning around the place there on the slide. I don't know what's happened. Thanks, PowerPoint. Must have a bug. Probably needs my tools. So in Baby Blue again, we've moved on from annotations. We threw them all away and changed the return type while we were there because it seemed easier to do so. And we decided to use some of the types that we're promoting in the GSL. Now there's one type that's not in the GSL there today, array buffer. It's a type we've talked about while we were working on the GSL and we just haven't baked it enough and don't think it's quite general enough yet to pop in there. But I'm going to keep it here in this example because I think it just illustrates the more general idea, which is types can replace annotations. Right? And they're more useful when you do. You can throw away your annotations. Note that I have barely changed the actual ugly code inside this function. Okay, so buffer, for ease of reference, think about it as just an array view with an extra size t in it, an extra integer in it that's saying, okay, just like array view, I point to somebody else's data. Just like array view, I know the data has a length. I also record another integer, which is how much of it you've written to or read from, depending on how you want to use that buffer. We call that the used length. And it's pretty useful in an example like this because you can look at the length and that tells you, well, am I big enough to take the payload that I want to write into? Yes, I am, good. And then you can use it and you can write into the buffer and you can set its length. So you can set its length and you can return. Setting its length appears to be missing from this slide for reasons I don't fully understand. But the point is we're using buffer.data and buffer.length down in our memcopy call. So we can use these types with minimal annotation, but the types ArrayView and ArrayBuffer carry the same information as the previous annotations did. An ArrayView, we know, has a size and a length, but now they're tied together. We can know this type, and we can know in the tools that it has those same properties as we had for annotations. Similarly, an ArrayBuffer has a size, a length, and a used, just like we saw in the outrights annotation. So we can understand how those things tie together. Makes it much simpler for the tools to look through this code and give us the same warning as we had before. But it's better because these types let us rewrite the code to become much simpler code. So these types let us say that received buffer, let's see if we can shrink it down as soon as we get it to match the length that the first few bytes told us it had. And if it can't, it's going to die. It's going to fail fast. That's what that first function will do. Just like all the operations on ArrayView, it's range checked. So the first thing we do when we get that ArrayView in that we're trying to read from is we say, okay, can I read the first three bytes? Well, length says yes, good. So I read the first few bytes, I work out how long the payload is, and then I just shrink down that array view. I shrink it by taking the first n bytes of it, if you like, from here on. Now the problem is, if it fails, you fail fast. Whether that's a good or a bad thing is up to you. You could put an if test in there first. You could if test the payload length against if, against rec.length. I chose not to because I was sort of running out of slide space. But the point is, whether you do the if test or not, this software will fail when the heartbleed bug tries to manifest itself. So the software is safer as well as easier to check. The tools know this. and the tools can leverage this, we can issue a warning at that line saying, oh, I see you're calling first without testing the value you're passing it against length. That could fail at runtime. Okay, you might want to check that first in case you want to handle the error more gracefully than just failing dead. And the programmer can make a decision there. So the beauty of this is we're able to simplify the implementation code, we're able to make it safer, and the tools can continue to do the same good job they did before. Now, this may not be so exciting if you don't currently have a code base filled with annotations that made it checkable by static analysis tools earlier. But if you do, this is a big leap forward because suddenly you can use these vocabulary types that are common and well-defined and portable and that you can exchange with other people. And you can get the same quality static analysis checking you got before, and you can prevent bugs. So let's see what happens in the caller. We don't even need to change the caller if we don't want to. So we can incrementally adopt these things, right? We don't have to go and change the annotations on every function in the system all at once. I think over time we probably should, because the types are clearly better than the annotations. After all, they're real sort of executable code. They're not some macro that just sits on top and gets looked at by analysis tools. They're real code that gets compiled. People use them, so they keep them in sync with what the software design is. They're maintained over time. But if you can't go modify your legacy OS socket read and OS socket write, the tools can still do the same detection they did before. Your calling code becomes slightly simpler to write because you simply construct an array buffer from your write buffer. The read buffer there, you can pass directly in because ArrayView constructs straight off a vector. It knows what the size of the vector is and it knows how to get the vector's data. So ArrayView just constructs with the same, a simpler set of arguments as it did before, and you can just call your same old function. So we're much more compatible. We don't need the annotations, but we can work with them. And these types don't have to be viral until you want them to. And I think the point is you want them to because they carry this extra information. So let's compare them to annotations. So just like with annotations, suddenly we can find these subtle defects we couldn't find before. We've made our intentions clearer by using the types. We've bound together the pointer and the length to make it clearer that these two things are related. And we can use them to reduce false positives. But the good thing is, these types are also checked by the compiler. So the type checker is doing some of the work for us. And in fact, some things you can't write anymore when you use the new types. And so a good example of that was resizing that receive buffer to be the wrong size. You can write it, but it's never going to run. Some of them you can't even write. If you try and construct it from a buffer and say, oh, I'll use buffer.data, some random number that's bigger, ArrayView will just say, oh, I can't compile if you're going to give me a container that I recognize and a size that's not from that container's size. Oh, I can't do that. If you construct one from a static array, if ArrayView can deduce the size of the static array and you're trying to tell it, oh, no, use a bigger size than that static array, well, it won't compile. So some defects are no longer possible when we use these types. As we said, they're not viral. You can preserve your legacy code and ABIs as you slowly move through the process of updating. They are source code, so they are kept up to date. They're not a language extension, so they're portable. And most importantly, our tools don't have to interpret what they mean the way we used to with annotations. What does in-reads mean? Does every tool think it means the same thing? Well, it better, because otherwise we get really confusing messages for the users. The semantics of a set of vocabulary types like the GSL are precisely defined. The tool needs to know them, but it needs to know them once. So we made it to green, the happy place, by using types. So now I'm going to go uncorporate. I'm going to break out from my value proposition and say there's a manifesto that we could have here, which is we should try and prevent defects from being constructed rather than just find them during construction. That's what the first half of the talk was about. Oh, I can find your bug. I can look at your old C code and find your bug. What we want to do is stop you writing the bugs as you go, because the cheapest bug to fix is the one you don't write at all. And so we get two new bullet points here. If we write less bugs, we make you more productive. If we add more information to your programs with types about what you're doing, we make everybody more productive. We improve your programs and make them clearer. When you say, I'm using an array view, instead of passing a pointer and some integer somewhere in the parameter list, you're saying, this is a contiguous sequence of elements I intend to read from. It's a much clearer statement. So how does this relate to the core guidelines that have been talked about this week? So that effort shares these same principles. Two things sort of go together. So a lot of the checks I've talked about are broader than that original. You know, they're talking about, oh, maybe this is about a buffer overflow, maybe this is a logic error, right? I've sort of taken us through the historical perspective. But the core guidelines effort has the same principles underlying it. We want clearer intent in programs. We want more effective static analysis results. And we're going to try and use types to do that, to make your programs contain more information, both to the reader and both to toolings, to make them safer. So I'm going to talk in the last few minutes here about CPP core check, which is just a name I've invented for the purpose of this slide, and that's the name of the tooling that we're going to ship sometime in the next month that will contain some of these initial checkers for the CPP core guidelines, and particularly for some of the profile rules that are identified in those guidelines. So my team built two checkers, really. There's one still under construction. One for the bounds profile, one for the types profile. So these were all mentioned in Herb's talk, so hopefully they're familiar. And the third one that's under construction there is the lifetime profile, which we demonstrated on stage yesterday. So we built these things using a framework that we've developed over the years for doing static analysis against individual functions. And that framework meant we could write bounds and types, and they're about 600 lines of C++ against our framework. So they're super small and super simple checks. And it's worth, I don't know how many of you have, but I encourage you to go look at the guidelines, look at those profiles in particular. They are very simple checks. You can tell that from reading them. The rules simply consist of, you know, don't make this sort of cast. Don't do pointer arithmetic. These are very simple things to check, very powerful once you adopt them. Let's talk about the framework we used to build these things for a moment. So we built our own framework in C++, greatest language in the world, blah, blah, blah. It's evolved over the years, and we've found it very useful. It was very useful in writing these checks. So it's somewhat portable C++, becoming more portable by the day. It is certainly compiler agnostic. There's a little layer where we talk to the compiler, where we want to get parse trees. I think I've run out of batteries, so I'll just continue on here. Parse trees and symbol information. Have another mic. Thank you.
Is that working?
Okay.
Yep. Nope.
So can you switch to this mic? I think his is out of battery.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah.
It's like 1,000.
Thank you. Perfect. There you go. My microphone became bored. Where was I? Ah, right. So we try to be compiler agnostic because, unsurprisingly, at a company as large as Microsoft, we've been through more than one iteration of C++ compilers in our time. So we've had to build an intermediate representation for doing analysis. So that's something like, for those of you familiar with compilers, it's a bit like a SSA type form, a CFG, where you can get a control flow graph built for you off of the compiler's internals. And those representations, the control flow graph, the types, the symbols, all that sort of information were built to be agnostic to the actual compiler front end that generates them for us. We've got, you know, parts in the framework that let us report warnings and maybe potential fixes. We know how to have things suppressed and how to honor those suppressions and tell you when the suppressions are broken. And we have a single consistent output format, and this is my chance to plug Sarif, which is our attempt to provide a sort of a standard format from all our static analysis tools at Microsoft. It's XML based because it's an output format and everybody loves XML, right? So easy to read. So we've got this framework. It's got two levels of analysis it supports for a local function. So one is what I was talking about before, which is simple checks, simple, fast, scalable checks. You can look at just the trees and work out, is somebody calling memset? What are the parameters? Do they look dodgy? Okay, I'll report a warning. You can also do very simple flow analysis. You can get a flow graph, you can walk the flow graph, you can record your own values, you can make your decisions about whether or not you want to report on something like dead code, as we showed in the earlier example. There's a second level of API, and I should just add, that first level of API is all you need to implement any of the checks that we've defined so far in the CPP core guidelines. They're all very simple, flow sensitive, but that's it, checks, even lifetimes. So that simple base API is more than enough to get you a long way in terms of value. There is a second level of API which does path sensitive walking through a function. So it explores all the potential paths, does full abstract execution, it's got a memory model and it's super sophisticated. As a result, it produces more false positives and it takes longer to run. So you don't need that sort of sophistication to be able to do nice deterministic checks like we want for the core guidelines, but it's still a useful thing to have in your bag of tricks if you're developing static analysis checks. So you write against a framework and then we get an execution engine. And that's what we're going to be bundling next month with these two tools. And that execution engine does all the hard work and does all that shared work I talked about before that helps you scale when you're running this thing all the time over a large code base. So it does a shared construction of this intermediate representation of the program. It's immutable to all the clients. It knows how to do all the warning reporting we talked about before. And if you're doing a flow-sensitive analysis, it gives you some standard ways to traverse that graph and ask questions about it and report. If you're doing the path-sensitive analysis, then that engine does all the hard work for you. It does an abstract interpretation of the program. It maintains all the values it thinks it's seen and evaluates expressions. And it's got path feasibility magic to it and constraint evaluation. It does a whole lot of work for you. And I like things that do work for me. And it lets you track your state along as it does its evaluation, ask questions, make decisions, issue warnings. It's a fairly simple model to use, but it's got a lot of power behind it. And so we plan to progressively share this, I guess, with the broader community as open source. So we're going to start with that first level and with the implementation of those CPP core guideline checks that we're releasing next month. In the months following, we will start to open source this stuff. I work at a very large company. A large company comes with a very large cohort of lawyers. Turns out that anytime you want to make anything available to the community, you have to talk to the large cohort of lawyers, and lawyers like to talk. I guess it's billable hours, right? So when I finish the talking with the lawyers, this stuff will start to trickle out, and we'll share it with you. And I encourage anybody who's interested to pick it up, look at it, improve it, make it better, just as I encourage people to do the same thing for the GSL and for the core guidelines. And I also encourage people who are interested to help us make it more portable, get it ported to other compilers if you think it's valuable. If it has use to you, pick it up, use it, make it better, spread it around. Because as we saw in that original couple of slides with Lint, Lint's value proposition is we all use it, we write better software, we go home earlier, and we have better weekends. Which I don't know about you, that is certainly my aim. So join us, is what I'm saying. Let's make everybody's inner loop better, even if you just run the tools, even if you help, even if you run other people's tools, I don't care. Join us and give people feedback on how to make things better. I've included in the deck a bunch of these resources. So Microsoft GitHub IO code analysis, thank you very much, Andrew, for getting that organized at very short notice. That's the sort of landing site where you can find a bunch of pointers and information to what we're doing at Microsoft with static analysis. And if you watch that space, that's where more information about these checkers and the project that underlies them will become available over time. I've put a link on there to the Serif standard, which is the output format we use, in case you'd be interested in either outputting it yourself from your own tools or consuming it to be able to do all sorts of interesting transformations on people's bugs. There's a link to code analysis in VS because that's what pays my bills. And there's a link to ClangTidy there as an example of something that doesn't pay my bills but is also a very useful and sophisticated static analysis tool that you should be using if you compile with Clang. So that's all I have. I have 5 minutes remaining, so if anybody has any questions, I'm more than happy to answer them or attempt to. Good sir.
So it seems like when you said use types instead of annotations, that seems really straightforward. That seems like you should do that. So why did we even have annotations? Why wasn't that just the natural things people used?
It's a great question. I'll just repeat it because that's what people will hold up a card and tell me to do. I just do what I'm told, right? And the question was, types rather than annotations seems blatantly obvious. Why didn't we just go straight there? Why did we bother going to annotations in the first place? There's a couple of good reasons. One is changing types is changing the code that people generate. And when we started using annotations a long time ago, there was a lot of nervousness back then about C++. Can it be performant? Can you really wrap things in a class and still get the same sort of performance as the raw C when I'm passing an integer and a pointer? It's not possible. This C++ thing will never take off. Believe it or not, there was a lot of people who felt that way. There still appear to be a lot of people who feel that way, and they're wrong. We all know they're wrong. That's why we're in this room, right? There's a second reason, and one was speed of adoption. So, you know, without going into too much detailed corporate history, but I think it's true of almost everybody who existed 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was a period of time where suddenly we realized that there were people who were not so nice out there in the world who wanted to attack the software that we make and people run and so on. And when you realize that, you suddenly, and you've got millions of lines of code that are that software, you've got something you need to do in a hurry. Changing all of the code that's being generated for that is a fairly risky project, so annotations seem like a safe thing to do because they're just macros, right? They don't contribute to code gen. You can put them on and not disturb the code base in a possibly harmful way, but you can still get the analysis checking. So part of it's historical as well. Great question. Anybody else? Okay, so it's a question about interprocedural analysis, and if I summarize it correctly, you're saying that there are some link time code gen scenarios are very similar or do actually do whole program optimization. It's the same sort of analysis. Some people have like an in-memory server to try and get around the big, hard, lots of work part of the problem, and did we consider that? Yes, so there's lots of different interprocedural efforts we've looked at over the years, and you know, we've got a research group who are always looking at more of them. But the main interprocedural engine we've used at Microsoft over the years, called Prefix, is an extremely precise engine. And it simply blows out memory on any machine. Like, it blows out storage and it blows out execution time on anything that is like reasonably realistic commercial code sizes that we deal with. So, you know, to give you some sort of an idea of the scale of the thing, you know, we were excited when we did a whole lot of work a year or two, maybe more, 2 or 3 years now back, to really optimize it so that instead of taking 2 weeks to run, it would take 2 days. And that was a big effort to get it to that point. So even if you ran it as a server, you're looking at a really long sort of turnaround. But you know, there's lots of gray areas. I mean, in this talk, I do talk about local and global as extremes. There's lots of positions in between where you can sort of turn the dial. But yeah, it's a 1 hour talk. So. Somebody at the back? Yep. Okay, so the question is, yes, if you have a bunch of developers who know they're smarter than the analysis tools and just want to silence them, how do you operate in that environment? I think if you're going to adopt these tools in a hostile environment, if you want to call it that, a great approach is the incremental adoption approach. So you need your tooling to support being able to be turned on for only parts of the code base, or being able to baseline an existing set of warnings, sort of like a hold the line position, and say, just tell me about new things. The experience we've had, and there's plenty of hostile developers to tools everywhere, the experience we've had is you need to show people the value. And so that goes back to that scaling proposition. When you've got thousands of engineers, you have a large percentage of them who know better than the tools, and each other. And so the best thing to do is you try and keep the noise very, very low to begin with, show people the real value. And in my experience, the day you help somebody find the bug they were just debugging, or that just shipped and is causing them deep embarrassment, is the day they stop being so critical of the tools and only mildly critical of the tools in the future. And my session is over. Thank you very much.